Menards is the ultimate home improvement destination in the Midwest. Since 1958, we've been supplying you with everything from hardware to automotive needs. We believe in helping you save big money on every project, big or small. From top-of-the-line tools to plumbing supplies, paint, and appliances, we've got you covered. We thank you for making Menards a part of your year. From our family to yours, have a safe and happy new year.
Save big money at Menards.
Welcome to Side Streets, a podcast about the history and geography of London. I'm Alan Hertz, Professor Emeritus of Humanities at Hull International Business School. Despite my accent, I've been prowling London and learning about its past for over 40 years. Side Streets is a Black Lab Media production, and my producer and editor is Wilhelm Schenk. My original plan for this month was to talk about more towers and pillars, some delightful ones that were planned but never built. But I've been distracted by the Thames, which is utterly beautiful at the moment. So I want to take some time to explore a fundamental aspect of London's history, the city's complex and changing relationship with its river system. I'm interested not just in the Thames, but also in its tributaries, which flow through London. Eventually, this episode will focus on the history of the Fleet. Nowadays, the Thames seems oddly separate from the city around it. In many places it is walled off by embankments, and most Londoners see it, if they see it at all, only when they cross it. But at least the Thames is a background presence in our lives. Many of its subsidiary streams have become storm sewers, swimming ponds, or garden features, not recognizable as rivers or completely invisible. Of course, for most of London's history, things were different. The Thames was as essential to London's social and economic life as it is central to London's geography, and some of those tributaries were almost equally important. The transformation of our waterways from vital to decorative is worth some careful examination. But first, a big general point. Before the spread of railways and highways, from Babylon and Harappa to Washington, cities were almost always sited on navigable bodies of water. The reason is absolutely fundamental. A city is, at least as I think of it, a settlement too densely populated to sustain itself. Like the people who inhabit it, it needs to eat and excrete, to import essentials from outside, and to get rid of its waste. In these essential tasks, a river is indispensable. A local source of food and water, a natural drainage system, it is also a power source and a highway for the trade which keeps the city and its population alive. But a river is never purely a benefit, it is also a threat. It comes with many dangers. Its banks are often disease-ridden marshes. It floods unpredictably. It brings raiders and invaders into the heart of the settlement. And as the city grows, those dangers increase. Human and industrial pollution becomes more noxious and more deadly. The bigger, richer community becomes a more attractive target for predators. Almost invariably, a disorderly shadow society develops along its riverbanks. Accounts of 18th century and 19th century London life teem with lists of the different criminal subcultures which thrive along or beside the Thames. They are often presented as an alternative and very threatening city. As the river becomes more deadly, technological advances enable the benefits it brings to be obtained by other means. Water can be piped in or brought up from wells. Food and other essentials can be delivered by train, wagon, or canal barge. Factories can be driven by coal. The river, which was once essential to the city's survival, becomes more and more a danger, less and less a lifeline. So, was this inevitable? For London to flourish, the Thames had to be tamed. This process had three dimensions. The first was canalization. The natural complexities of the river, its marshes and meanders, its tidal variations, were regularized with drainage, dredging, walls and weirs. Some of London's most spectacular developments, Canary Wharf, London City Airport, the Thames Barrier, illustrate this process. But it goes back to the Romans, who began reclaiming marshland and building protective embankments almost as soon as they arrived. A second dimension was cleansing. The natural mess and artificial pollution created by human settlement had to be purged. When the Romans founded London, it was above the furthest reach of the tides. The city's waste was all swept safely downstream. But the southeast of England is sinking, and the Thames has become more and more tidal. Now the average difference between high and low tide at London Bridge is 7 meters. Moreover, waste-producing industry and population have grown, so the threat to London's public health from its poisoned rivers has vastly increased. Bazalgette's great sewer system, possibly London's single greatest civil engineering achievement, was a necessary and long overdue response. The third dimension was civilization. The human subcultures that emerged along the river had to be subjugated. In my episode about the rock and roll culture of Richmond and Twickenham, I mentioned a recent example of this, the suppression of the commune on Eel Pie Island. The public execution of pirates on the Wapping foreshore is a more ghoulish one. Ways of life which depend on the river, but which prey on, threaten, disgust, or simply inconvenience the vast land-based population are doomed. As the river was tamed in these three overlapping ways, it was reduced to a symbolic relic of its former importance, still emblematic of, but now marginal to, the life and culture of the city. It has been made safe, but it has also been made largely irrelevant. One day, I don't know how many years ago, I was procrastinating through Covent Garden, avoiding the grading of student papers by doing some on-the-ground research. In the market was a man selling prints and posters, and in the center of his stall was a glorious cityscape, a bird's-eye view of the London that might have been built after the Great Fire, if Christopher Wren's comprehensive plan had been realized. The man might have been Paul Draper, the artist, himself. You can find his image for yourselves on his website. It has been an inspiration to me ever since, and though I paid the absurdly low price he asked, I am still very much in his debt. Draper's image shows the north end of a rebuilt London Bridge, with Temple Bar reimagined as its northern gate. The gate faces a grand semicircular piazza, with the monument at its center and wide streets radiating out through the city. The widest two of those avenues run along a completely reconfigured riverside. The Thames has been straightened and bounded by high stone embankments. There are docking places for boats, but wharves and warehouses have been banished. This was an essential feature of Wren's project, the jumble of tenements and storehouses that had cluttered the north bank of the Thames. Wasn't just unacceptably untidy, it was also dangerous. The flammable contents of those warehouses had accelerated the spread of the fire. So Wren's new riverside, imagined beautifully in Draper's image, is no longer a port. It is an orderly, spacious combination of arterial road, promenade, and water taxi stand. The story of the failure to execute Wren's plan, or the rival plans of Robert Hooke and John Evelyn, deserves an episode of its own. I bring Draper's image up to note that Wren, like other thinkers about London before and since, understood that the taming of the Thames was a vital part of any attempt to modernize London. I also bring it up because I want to extend it, to talk about a feature of Wren's design that is out of sight off the left edge of the picture. Unlike most of what Draper shows us, this bit largely got built. Draper's image shows us Wren's plans for the area east of St. Paul's, and they were very ambitious indeed. But his vision for the western part of the city was even more radical. In fact, Wren proposed to shift the whole city to the west. Between the River Fleet and the Temple, he wanted an enormous octagonal piazza, one of three focal points for his new city. The most important of the 8 roads running from this piazza would go due east, crossing the Fleet on a grand new bridge. At the base of Ludgate Hill, it would split, with two roads running on either side of the second of his focal points, a rebuilt St. Paul's Cathedral. The northern of those roads would go to the third great focus, a rebuilt Royal Exchange. The Romans had built Londinium on two hills, where St. Paul's and the Royal Exchange are now, with the Walbrook running between. By Wren's time, the Walbrook had disappeared, so Wren reimagined London on three hills, with the Fleet running between the western two. For most of London's history, the Fleet was its western boundary. It would now become a more central feature. Great idea. But one big problem was the state of the Fleet, a suppurating ditch, bubbling with industrial waste, the unsaleable parts of the animals butchered at Smithfield, and the outflow from London's largest public toilet. Its banks festered with an unsavory mixture of prisons, mills, and slums. It clogged up almost as often as it flooded, and it invariably stank beyond the endurance of a population very tolerant of evil smells. I know my language has become a bit florid, but hyperbole is impossible in this case. The Fleet was unimaginably disgusting. If it was to be a centerpiece of Wren's new modern city, it would have to be not just tamed, but completely transformed. The Fleet was the most important tributary of the Thames in the central London area, but it was a very different kind of river. It had its source in the hills of Hampstead Heath and fell over 100 meters over roughly 10 kilometers. So it did not meander like the Thames. It rushed. The two rivers both flooded, but did so very differently. The Fleet from upstream after heavy and prolonged rain, the Thames from downstream due to tidal or storm surges from the North Sea. When its flow was unimpeded, the Fleet was fast enough to power water mills, and it did so from Roman times into the 18th century, but it also flowed through highly developed and heavy populated areas for over 1,000 years. Its proximity to the meat market at Smithfield and the leatherworking district north of High Holborn was especially important. The unusable bits of various animals ended up in its waters, and the river was simply not big enough to cope. The earliest surviving complaints about the stench from those living by its southern banks came in the 12th century. This pollution was particularly unfortunate since the Fleet naturally widened considerably at its southern end. Near its junction with the Thames, it was wide and deep enough for ocean-going shipping, and indeed this was an important port area for the Romans. At the heart of Wren's vision for the Fleet was a revival of this function. In his new city, the mouth of the Fleet was to become London's primary docking point on the north side of the Thames. As such, it would be central to London's commercial life. Wren had an important partner in this project. Robert Hooke, the hero of my episode about the monument, had also produced a master plan for the reconstruction of London. That plan had also included a transformed Fleet. Hooke was the city surveyor, responsible for laying out the streets and property boundaries of the city as it rose from its ashes, so he would inevitably have been involved in any project to develop the Fleet. Both men were fantastically busy in the years after the fire, but Hooke took primary responsibility for these works, making regular visits to the site and supervising the details of construction. Wren and Hooke called their project the New Canal. I can't help but find the name significant. It tells us as plainly as it can that the lower reaches of the Fleet were to be reduced from a natural phenomenon to a human construction. It was to become the riverine equivalent of a domesticated animal. Wren and Hooke were ambitious men with big imaginations. They proposed to dredge and widen the mouth of the Fleet, to embank the river on both sides for the lower 2,000 feet of its course, to create a navigable canal 50 feet wide with 30 feet of wharfage covering subterranean warehouses on either side. New bridges, high enough to allow ships to sail beneath them, would carry Fleet Street and High Holborn across the canal. The spaces beneath the access roads rising to these spans would provide further warehouse space. It's well known that Wren's great plan for London went largely unrealized. It would have required long, complex, and expensive mechanisms to compensate those who would have lost their land or had to move, and the need to rebuild was too urgent. Even the attempt to regularize the riverside stalled in the face of opposition from property owners and boatmen. But once legislation allowed money from the coal tax to fund the project, construction of the new canal got underway in 1670. It didn't go well. Embanking the fleet proved much more difficult than anticipated. The technology used along the Thames proved inadequate to hold back the steeper banks of the smaller river. Dredging was even more difficult. For one thing, work at the mouth could only be done at low tide. This required a fleet of 14 boats working in two shifts and supported by a battery of pumps. Further upstream, the fleet was dammed to make work possible, but groundwater kept seeping into the building site. The biggest problem was cultural. People living and working upstream continued to use the fleet to dispose of their waste, and as they were rebuilding after the fire themselves, they had more waste than ever. To combat this, upper stretches of the river were covered over, and grates were placed under Holborn Bridge to catch rubbish. But the covers were repeatedly vandalized, and the gratings created an artificial waterfall, which might have been picturesque, but made the subtle maneuvers of docking difficult. In the end, the project took 4 years and cost over £50,000. It was not a success. The port facilities were never used much and were eventually sold off. The canalside spaces turned out to be valuable in ways Wren and Hook never intended, becoming important north-south arterial roads and marketplaces. Above Holborn Bridge, the banks of the fleet remained pretty wild for another century. Saffron Hill and Hockley in the Hole were notorious slums. Even in the 1830s, Charles Dickens puts Fagin's Lair in the former. The magnificent closing lines of Jonathan Swift's description of a city shower from 1710 sum the condition of the Feral River up better than I can. Now from all parts the swelling kennels flow and bear their trophies with them as they go. Filth of all hues and odors seem to tell what street they sailed from by their sight and smell. They, as each torrent drives with rapid force from Smithfield or St. Pulchre's, shape their course, and in huge confluence joined at Snow Hill Ridge, fall from the conduit prone to Holborn Bridge. Sweepings from butcher's stalls, dung, guts, and blood, drowned puppies, stinking sprats all drenched in mud, dead cats and turnip tops come tumbling down the flood. In the mid-18th century, the new canal was completely abandoned, and the lower fleet was buried under the access road to the new Blackfriars Bridge. The upper reaches of the fleet were covered over in the 19th century, but it still peeks out in a couple of places. It crosses over the Metropolitan Line in a big pipe just west of Farringdon Station, and its headwaters have been turned into the swimming ponds in Hampstead Heath. But the taming is now virtually complete, and the river is now either invisible or recreational. The failure of the new canal teaches an important lesson. The project was an engineering success. No, an engineering triumph. Wren and Hook successfully overcame startlingly difficult physical problems. They developed embankments that held back seepage and mudslides. They developed complex dredging techniques that dealt with the muddy bed and the recurrent tides. But they were defeated by the lawless subculture of those who dwelt by the river and dumped their refuse in it. Canalization was easier to achieve than civilization. In our next episode, we will meet Patrick Cahoon, as committed a modernizer as Wren and Hook, and see how he tackled those cultural obstacles head on. Well, that's enough for now. Thanks for listening. This episode was researched, written, and presented by me, Alan Hertz. Side Streets is a Black Lab Media production, and my producer and editor is Wilhelm Schenk.